Again, to talk about Malcolm X and his very fundamental impact upon American political and cultural life. And perhaps more than any other figure in African American history, Malcolm is the quintessential black male. More than any other male in African American history, the figure of Malcolm X is most firmly anchored as the personification of black masculinity. Actor Ossie Davis's eloquent and emotional words at Malcolm's funeral anticipated this gendered overdetermination by claiming that, quote, Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. This masculinist theme was quickly and broadly incorporated into the new protest literature of the period, characterized by the concept of the black arts movement or the black aesthetic. There were a number, quite literally, hundreds and hundreds of poems, dozens of plays, written in homage to Malcolm X, the black man, the quintessential black shining prince. Here are two poems. One, a fragment of a poem by Joyce, Whitchett. Malcolm was the perfect black martyr, the truth-seeking, brilliant embodiment of elusive manhood. You were the brilliant embodiment of elusive black manhood. Those who are less negative concerning your death and fail to acknowledge righteousness felt your logic. O beautiful black martyr, cut down by black hands, held down by little white minds, send back your song to a century wrong, yet seeking one of your golden throat, your growing notes of truth. A poem that was written in honor of Dudley Randall, entitled Malcolm X, by the brilliant poet Gwen Brooks, Gwendolyn Brooks, reads, original, hence ragged round, hence rich, robust. He had the hawkman's eyes, we gasped. We saw the maleness raking out and making guttural the air and pushing us to walls. And in a soft and fundamental hour, a sorcery devout and vertical beguiled the world. He opened us, who was a key, who was a man. So you see in the poetry this kind of masculine image of Malcolm X. My favorite poem, despite its blatant homophobia, and I really do need to read it because it's an elegant poem and it expresses all the contradictions that you find in the black arts movement, is a poem by my friend Amiri, Leroy Jones, a poem for black hearts. For Malcolm's eyes, when they broke the face of some dumb white man, for Malcolm's hands raised to bless us, all black and strong in his image of ourselves, for Malcolm's words, fire darts, the victor's tireless thrusts, words hung above the world, change as it may, he said it. And for this, he was killed. For saying and feeling and being change, all collected hot in his heart, for Malcolm's heart, raising us above our filthy cities, for his stride, for his beat, for his address to the gray monsters of the world, for Malcolm's pleas for your dignity, black men, for your life, black men, for the filling of your minds with righteousness. For all of him dead and gone and vanished from us, and all of him which clings to our speech, black God of our time, for all of him and all of yourself, look up, black man, quit stuttering and shuffling. Look up, black man, quit whining and stooping. For all of him, for great Malcolm, a prince of the earth, let nothing in us rest until we avenge ourselves for his death, stupid animals that killed him. Let us never breathe a pure breath if we fail, and white men call us faggots till the end of the earth. From Malcolm. Many of the creative writers and artists of the late 60s and 70s seized on this image. Malcolm as legitimate black masculinity. In the words of the very perceptive cultural critic Philip Bryan Harper, the historic division between liberal integrationism versus black nationalism, first represented in the mid-19th century by the tension between Frederick Douglass on one hand and Martin R. Delaney on the other, is in a way reconciled in a newly gendered axis. As Harper has critically observed, the 1960s argument that Malcolm X and the politics of black nationalism are represented as authentic black masculinity implied that the politics of conventional black leadership, who favored integration, must therefore be characterized by smallness, puniness, weakness. In other words, as Harper puts it, racialized stereotypes of the non-masculine, the effeminate, the feminized, and the feminine. The social reality behind the myth that Malcolm was the primordial black man is, of course, far more complicated. Malcolm grew up in a household where his father routinely physically used force to discipline his children and at times to intimidate and beat his wife. Betty Shabazz relates that Malcolm was, quote, apprehensive about marriage because, quote, the only thing he could remember about his mother and father was argument, unquote. After his father's death and Louise Little's subsequent mental breakdown, Malcolm seemed later to attribute most of his teenage shame and alienation to the failures of his mother. So, as Detroit Red, Malcolm lived the life of a street hustler, dealing drugs, engaging in petty theft and burglary just to get by. In the racialized world of the Hep Cats and the Zoot Suiters, the most valuable signifier of black male prowess was the domination of the white woman. As the autobiography relates, Malcolm equated his sexual relationship with Sophia with winning a trophy. His sexual domination of a white girl gave the young hustler status and peer recognition. Malcolm writes, in his own words, "Important black hustlers and smart boys were clapping me on the back, getting us up with drinks at special tables. Of course, I knew their reason, like my own name. They wanted to steal my fine white woman away from me," unquote. As Detroit Red, as Big Red, Malcolm learned the pleasures of the body, the joy of creativity of music, the athleticism of the ballroom dancing, the sensuality of sexual intimacy. After Malcolm's incarceration and subsequent entrance into the NOI, all of those emotional experiences were shut off and packed up, bundled into memories. But the years of streetwise hustling left an indelible mark on the black Muslim minister. Malcolm deeply respected his half-sister Ella Collins and the constant emotional and economic support she provided him. But Malcolm interpreted Ella's strength in masculinist terms. Her economic self-sufficiency, Ella's intelligence, her refusal to be intimidated or harassed by a male, her refusal to knuckle under the young minister, Louis Farrakhan, in Boston's Muslim temple, were all signifiers of her lack of femininity. Now, he admired strong and uncompromising black women, but at a distance, the Billie Holidays, Abby Lincoln. But within his own sphere, in his own marriage, Malcolm felt it necessary to exert patriarchal authority. The sins of his former life of ghetto street corners and juke joints were exorcised, replaced by extremely conservative standards for defining black sexuality and masculinity that was established and confirmed by the authoritarian NOI. As early as the mid-1950s, Elijah Muhammad began having sexual relations with his personal secretaries and other NOI women. For years, Muhammad's chief lieutenant at Chicago's Temple No. 2 was able to contain the rumors, sometimes through fear and intimidation. Scholar Carl Evans estimates that the total number of children born from Elijah Muhammad's affairs or sexual contacts was at least 13. In the Spike Lee film, Malcolm is presented as being completely and utterly in the dark about Elijah Muhammad's sexual conduct. Now, although the NOI was unquestionably a patriarchal and deeply conservative institution, the role and significance of women in all aspects of the organization's works should not be underestimated. Clara Muhammad, for example, Elijah Muhammad's wife, was said to have been the first introduced her husband to the teachings of the sect's founder, W.D. Fard. Clara Muhammad was largely responsible for establishing the University of Islam in Detroit in 1943. When Elijah Muhammad was incarcerated during World War II, it was Clara who really held together the organization. And so the NOI should not be simply understood as a series of black patriarchs, because women, black women, formed the institution, and very much like the Christian church, were really the backbone of the organization. In his autobiography, Malcolm X candidly revealed misogynistic, patriarchal views about women in general, and particularly about his wife. When he first was released from prison and became a Muslim minister, Malcolm X firmly states that, quote, a woman's true nature is to be weak, and that any man, quote, must control his woman if he expects to get her respect, unquote. During an interview with Alex Haley, Malcolm X observed that, quote, you can never fully trust a woman. I've got the only one I've ever met I would trust 75%. I've told her that. I've seen too many men destroyed by their wives or their women, unquote. Don't kill the messenger. I'm just telling you what Malcolm had to say in the autobiography. Well, before his marriage to Betty Shabazz, according to Evans, Malcolm had been romantically attached to another woman in Temple No. 7, Evelyn Williams, or Evelyn X. Supposedly, according to Evans, and also other sources, when Evelyn X was informed that Malcolm had married another woman, Betty Shabazz, she fled the mosque in tears. Elijah Muhammad then became sexually involved with her, subsequently. As Evelyn X. Williams later informed the press, quote, he told us that under the teaching of the Holy Quran, we were not committing adultery and that we were his wives, unquote. By 1962, when Clara Muhammad became fully aware of her husband's extramarital activities, she actually receded from active participation in the organization. So Malcolm, streetwise Detroit Red, had to be aware of these rumors about Elijah Muhammad's behavior. Now, given Malcolm's patriarchal attitudes about women and marriage in general, it is not surprising that his relationship with Betty quickly ran into difficulties. In his autobiography, Malcolm confesses that the couple often had quarreled about money and later about issues of family security. Malcolm criticized his wife's, as he put it, quote, luxurious lifestyle. Betty, in turn, argued that Malcolm, quote, should put away something for our family. But then Malcolm said, but I refused. Malcolm had convinced himself that if anything ever happened to him, that the NOI would take care of his family. He later, only when he realized his mistake, Malcolm describes himself, quote, "I could never have been a bigger fool," unquote. Betty's difficulties with her husband led her to seek separations from him on three different occasions. Now, Malcolm does not state this in the autobiography, but we know this from interviews that Betty subsequently gives after Malcolm X's assassination. In fact, she sought separations from him on three different occasions, each after the births of their oldest three children, Adela in 1958, Kabila in 1960, and Ilyasa in 1962. The full extent of Malcolm and Betty's unhappiness in their marriage was not, however, known until 2002, after the passing away of both Betty and Malcolm, when a four-page letter, written apparently by Malcolm X, and addressed to Elijah Muhammad, dated March the 25th, 1959, became public on the internet. Moments in Time, a company that sold and auctioned historical memorabilia, posted a digital copy of the correspondence online. Malcolm X scholars reviewing the document generally concurred that the text was authentic. It had been typed by Malcolm X, and the text sounds like Malcolm. Moments in Time's advertisement described the document as, quote, "the most exceptional letter of Malcolm X ever to hit the market." The contents of the letter detailed the marital and sexual problems of Malcolm X, then experiencing with his wife of then 2 years, Betty. The letter states that Malcolm had been extremely reluctant to become married. He denied accusations that he had ever engaged in sexual intercourse with several female members of the NOI. Quote, "I stayed single for a long time because I knew my own weaknesses and shortcomings," Malcolm writes. When I did marry, it was at a time of great mental and spiritual weakness on my part," unquote. The letter revealed that soon after the marriage, the relationship quickly drifted downhill, quote unquote. Malcolm complained that to his mentor about his spouse's luxurious tastes, which I immediately began to curb. But the central tension between the two was, frankly, sexual. In frank and very explicit language, the letter describes certain sexual intimacies and details about Betty's unhappiness with Malcolm's lovemaking. Now, critics of the letter released charged that the intimate sexual details of Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz are irrelevant to a historical appreciation of their lives. One African-American historian, William Jelani Cobb, argued on the internet when the letter soon came out, quote, that one's right to privacy does not end in death. I fail to see the significance of Betty and Malcolm's sex life in our understanding of a Pan-Africanist visionary, unquote. The rejoinder to that is, that's perhaps true, but the details about a historical figure's intimate relationships, even sexual preferences, are important factors that reveal the full person. Jimmy Baldwin's homosexuality was an important dimension of his personality and how he came to define his art and his politics. Martin Luther King Jr.'s widely reported sexual appetites for women add little to an understanding of his politics and his public life, but one must also at the same time acknowledge that the personal is always political, that you cannot draw a kind of arbitrary line between the personal, between the public and the private, and expect to understand a full portrait of the individual, that all of that is a part of the mix. You could not understand Bayard Rustin unless you fully understand how he had to deal with homosexuality, hide that, how he was arrested for it, and how that had an impact upon his effectiveness or lack of effectiveness as a political leader. So in the final months of his life, Malcolm grappled seriously with women's oppression, but not without difficulties and not without contradictions. As he was introduced to female leaders and grassroots organizers in more progressive civil rights organizations, such as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, he recognized the centrality of the work of women at a December 1964 forum at the Audubon Ballroom. He appears with the legendary Fannie Lou Hamer. And Malcolm states, quote, "When I listened to Mrs. Hamer, a black woman, it could be my mother, my sister, my daughter, describe what they had done to her in Mississippi. And I asked myself, how in the world can we ever expect to be respected as men when we will allow something like that to be done to our women and we do nothing about it? How can you and I be looked upon as men with black women being beaten and nothing being done about it? No, we don't deserve to be recognized and respected as men as long as women can be brutalized in the manner that this woman described," unquote. One could characterize Malcolm's position then as enlightened patriarchy, that in effect, or benevolent patriarchy, that is, that black women deserve to be placed on the pedestal along with white women. But it's not an emancipatory view. It is a patriarchal nationalist struggling with the contradictions in his own life, trying to move toward a more egalitarian position. But death cuts it short. He never quite makes it. Now, black feminists have had to considerable difficulty in presenting a critical yet balanced perspective of Malcolm's evolving ideas about black women, gender, and masculinity. One of the most insightful commentaries was delivered by the celebrated poet and author Audre Lorde as a lecture celebrating Malcolm X at Harvard University about 20 years ago. Lorde recalls that, quote, "In his last year of life, Malcolm X added a breath to his essential vision. Before he was killed, Malcolm had altered and broadened his opinions concerning the role of women in society and the revolution. He was beginning to speak with increasing respect of the connection between himself and Martin Luther King Jr., whose policies of nonviolence appeared to be so opposite to his own," unquote. Malcolm X, in short, to conclude on this part, was deeply patriarchal. He was a product of a religious organization that was patriarchal. And yet, Lorde finds in Malcolm's living model a model of social justice for our time. A man filled with contradictions, yet having the courage to challenge himself. As Lorde ends her statement, as Malcolm X stressed, quote, "We are not responsible for our oppression, but we must be responsible for our own liberation."